Thank you. Well, welcome, members. We're glad to see you here today, and we have a full agenda, so we appreciate you being with us. See, we have one member here that hasn't been here before, Representative Diskin. So we did introductions the other day, and you had to say, let's see, where you lived when you were three, your favorite childhood game, and what committees you're on. Could you share with us?
Thank you, Madam Speaker, members. My name is Mark Diskin, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. Thank you. Mark Diskins, representing 35B, which is the greater section of Scott County. And I share Scott County with my good friend, Representative Bly. Let's see, where was I when I was three? I think I was, I honestly, Belle Plaine, Minnesota, I think. Right? So, had my parents have stayed there, we'd be Representative Bly's constituents. Toys, we made guns out of sticks and romped around in the room, and cowboys and Indians, and I know it's not PC nowadays, but that's what we did. The committees I'm on, I do have the pleasure of serving on K-12 Finance with Representative Greiling to my left. My far left.
No editorial comments.
I'm on the Finance Committee, local government, early childhood, of course, and I know I'm missing one, but my LA keeps me on track. I'm sorry I wasn't able to attend the last few weeks. My wife left me. But she came back, so I'm a happy guy now. Right? She is from Guayaquil, Ecuador, and for the first time in 15 years was able to go back and visit her parents and her brothers and sisters. And so I was Mr. Mom and Mr. Dad and everything for the last few weeks, so I apologize, Madam Chair.
No problem. Thank you, Representative Diskins. We missed you, so we wanted you to know that, and are glad you're back. Members, today we have all the different advocates have come. Some are working on child care, some work in early ed. We have a variety. I think you have the list in your packets. And so with that, we will proceed. If we're going to have Todd Otis and Kate Wolford and Missy Staples-Thompson come down. And while they're coming down, I want to say, members, these are three of the best leaders in early childhood you will ever see. Todd's probably going to get his background, but he's been doing this for several years and started many of the initiatives on early childhood. And the McKnight Foundation, which Kate heads, has been very supportive, as well as United Way. So welcome to the committee. Mr. Otis, if you'd like to start.
Great to be here. Thank you, Madam Chair. And what a joy to be able to testify to a legislative committee on this day. I mean, this is a huge historical day. And to be part of the process and to be able to be with you is just doubly important in light of the major changes that are going on in the country.
Well, we're pleased you're here.
Thank you. I'll be brief. I understand we don't have much time individually, but I'm president of Ready for K, an early childhood advocacy group that's 7.5 years old. Our mission is to try to raise public awareness and support to improve public policy so that all our kids will be ready for kindergarten. We are kind of guided by the school readiness assessment that indicates about half our kids are fully prepared for kindergarten. And we believe that that gives us the foundation to build public policy to get better. And so we feel that in our mission, it's been to try to unite and organize the early childhood community, broaden the base of support by helping business and other sectors get more deeply involved, and ultimately to try to bring about public policy that will bring quality early learning experiences to every child in the state. And that's really done by parents as well as providers. So much of our public policy recommendations ultimately have that as the bottom line. That's the widget that we're trying to produce, quality early learning experiences for kids. So our principles at Ready for K are that parents are at the center of all of this, and giving them better choices is what it's all about. Access to quality includes resources that parents and families would have to be able to afford it. Quality is a huge word in this, so quality is one of our key principles. We know from the Department of Human Services study several years ago that kids in accredited centers were way more likely to be ready for K using the same work sampling system that the statewide sampling showed us to have only half the kids ready for K. So quality is huge. And then building a system where all the pieces are in place to make sure that every child is ready for K. We think that the benefits have been well explained. The Federal Reserve has done studies showing that both in K-12 education, jobs, every aspect of people's life is better if they start strong. So we continue to believe that this is a grossly or significantly underfunded area compared to the benefits and the need. 1% of the state budget is just not enough to provide the quality early learning experiences kids deserve. So with that, there are many things to talk about. I know you're really pressed for time. We hope you'll look at us as a resource during the coming session. And just one final vignette about why I really think when the legislature in its entirety, as well as the governor, look at this issue, they will see that this is really the number one dollar that should be spent in our state budget. Several years ago, a group called the Public Strategies Group, which consults with states all over this country, met with Governor Vilsack of Iowa, and they went through a process with him saying, let's stand back from the picture, divorce ourselves from all of the spending patterns that have existed up until now, and come back to us, Governor, with where you think dollar one should go. And here was a man who was not overly dedicated to early childhood at the time. So he followed the assignment of the Public Strategies Group and came back to them and said dollar one should be spent on early childhood. So we think that it's not outrageous, even in this difficult budget, to ask you to think the same way and do all you can to help us get more resources for kids so they'll be ready for K. With that,
thank you. What we'll have you do is stay up there, and members, we have time for a couple of questions after each. Kind of, we're going to beam people up in groups, so if there are questions, let's hear all three and then do questions after that. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Kate Wolford, and I serve as president of the McKnight Foundation, and I'm also very pleased to be here on this historic day to testify. For over 50 years, McKnight has supported programs and policies that provide opportunities for all of the residents of Minnesota. We employ strategies that we believe produce the greatest outcomes for the resources invested. In the 1990s, several intersecting issues came together that led us to really make a significant commitment to early childhood care and education. One was that women were entering the workforce in ever greater numbers, prompting greater attention to aspects of child development that take place outside of the home as well as those that take place inside the home. At the same time in the 90s, leading research was giving us new insights into the importance of brain development in the earliest years of children's development. Applied with research and strategies to address the changing needs of Minnesota's families, the McKnight Foundation Board recognized an opportunity to leverage public and private resources to address this critical need, and we jumped into this field with full force. Other colleagues in the private, public, nonprofit sector did the same, and together we've been working for almost two decades now to create a comprehensive system for early childhood care and education. With more than two decades of experience behind us, our belief remains strong in the great value of high quality, affordable, and accessible early child care and development. More than 80% of Minnesota's women with children are in the workforce today. At the same time, Minnesota faces the growing needs of an increasingly diverse population, a changing workforce, and in today's economy, struggling families. The need has never been greater for high-quality programs for our state's youngest investment. That's why just in the last year alone, McKnight invested $7 million in programs to support our goals. However, these are still limited resources, so we pay a lot of attention to long-term outcomes. We believe that the greatest returns are in programs that are investing early so that we don't have to do so much remediation that's more costly later in the age pipeline. Support for early development is among our most important investments in closing the achievement gap at the earliest possible stage and improving outcomes for future generations. We've worked together with the state of Minnesota and our nonprofit partners in this effort. We focus our grant making in three areas which we believe are instrumental to creating a comprehensive system of early care and education. One is around increasing public will and public commitment. Many of you are leaders in that effort. We support research and advocacy with the goal of securing adequate and sustained investments in high-quality care and opportunity. We're focused on quality, quality, and quality. In partnership with state and other funders, we've supported the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation and others. In this case, I particularly want to highlight the efforts to develop the parent-aware quality rating system. It is a unique system in the nation and one which we believe holds so much promise for the future. We continue to support efforts in that area, funding grantees who are now working on the complementary track of helping child care providers meet the standards and increase the quality so that parents can have confidence and have choice in the system. And finally, we focus on access and affordability. Recognizing our changing demographics, we promote and support efforts to design more culturally appropriate and culturally specific care and education, including outreach to home-based family, friend, and neighbor care providers. We also target grants, again, an example would be to the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, to test tools and activities that provide high-quality care, but at affordable cost and accessible to all. In conclusion, we believe that investing in early care and education is the right thing to do and also the smart thing for Minnesota's future. Your consideration of Parent Aware as a policy framework for current and future investments is an important step forward in that process. A comprehensive and adequately funded system will focus on quality, access, and affordability to parents throughout our state and produce a great return on investment. We look forward to working with all of you to accomplish that goal. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to proceed, introduce yourself first.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Missy Staples-Thompson, and I am Vice President of the Early Learning Initiative at Greater Twin Cities United Way. Greater Twin Cities United Way has a long and rich history of supporting early childhood care and education going back to the late 1980s, when the Minneapolis United Way worked closely with the business and nonprofit community, local and state policymakers, to develop the Success by Six initiative. This groundbreaking initiative, duplicated by other communities throughout the country, recognized the importance of early education in preparing children for success in school, and has informed much of United Way's work in this area, both locally and nationally, for almost 20 years. Most recently, our Greater Twin Cities United Way has put forth our Agenda for Lasting Change, 10 measurable goals, all working in concert to create pathways out of poverty for 500,000 people in the Twin Cities region living on or at the edge of poverty. The agenda is a mix of programs that meet immediate basic needs and long-term preventative programs such as our work in early learning, the strategy we believe is the keystone for all of the rest of the social and economic issues that face our community. That's why United Way has agreed to be a key partner in helping to achieve this goal. We knew our work would play a critical role in achieving the broader vision, but also recognized we couldn't achieve this vision on our own. Over the past 3 years, United Way has taken responsibility by investing in programs that work, beginning to pilot test innovative and promising practices, working in partnership with other organizations, and building relationships with policymakers and community leaders with an eye towards systems change. I'd like to spend a moment outlining the key elements of our work in what Greater Twin Cities United Way's Early Learning Initiative is all about. First, in the area of access, United Way funds programs providing high-quality learning focused on kindergarten readiness for kids at 200% of poverty or below, communities of color, new immigrant and refugee populations. We currently support approximately 7,800 children in 58 sites throughout our 9-county service region, thus reaching up to 12% of the 65,000 low-income children in the metro area. Over 90% of the children in United Way-funded agencies, which target low-income, high-risk children, demonstrate age-appropriate development. Our current investment is about $4.3 million. In terms of quality, we're enhancing other promising community efforts rather than reinventing the wheel. As an example, the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, MELF, in conjunction with the Department of Human Services and the Minnesota Child Care Resource and Referral Network, has launched the quality rating tool Parent Aware, which Kate mentioned. Parent Aware voluntarily evaluates and rates child care centers, preschools, and home-based child care sites. Participating providers can receive a 1 to 4 star rating to let parents know how well they prepare children for school. United Way's goal, working closely with MELF, is to provide training for over 1,000 providers to ensure they receive the highest parent aware rating. In the parenting area, we are testing promising practices with the goal of finding and then supporting the most innovative work in early learning. We're especially focused on parenting programs, one area that's challenging and yet most promising for children's success. We recognize that an engaged, knowledgeable set of parents are one of the most important elements in a child's access to success. Through a major new two-year, $2.2 million investment in 14 different parenting programs, we will be discovering the best programs, whether currently funded or not, evaluating their effectiveness through Wilder research, and then working to take them to scale. Special programs such as parent education through home visits by parents as teachers, child care provided in bilingual settings, as well as weekly reading circles at the Jeremiah program in both Minneapolis and St. Paul, and literacy activities at St. David's Child Development and Family Services have been made possible through a gift from United Way's Women's Leadership Council, a collaboration of women community leaders committed to raising money to ensure our community's children are ready to succeed in school. We have been and will continue to build strong relationships and credibility with the early childhood community, other funders and policymakers, with an eye towards system alignment, as we recognize building and maintaining trusted relationships with others in the field will be critical to the success of getting Minnesota's children ready for school. We've been working and will continue to work closely with members of the Early Childhood Caucus at the legislature by continuing our funding of an educator who acts as staff to the caucus so policymakers can make informed votes on early childhood issues. This educator reports directly to caucus leaders. In the past 10 months, we've ramped up our support by bringing in a national expert to assist policymakers in looking at possible public financing sources for early childhood education based on models used in other states. United Way is also partnering with a group of major Minnesota foundations, including the Blandin Foundation, Bush Foundation, Grotto Foundation, McKnight Foundation, Minneapolis Foundation, Social Venture Partners, and Sheltering Arms Foundation, in developing a comprehensive business plan to guide the state in the area of early education and care for the next 5 to 7 years. The plan is being conducted in two phases, fact-finding and plan development. A thorough asset review of Minnesota's early care programs, initiatives, and funding has been completed, revealing that Minnesota has excellent efforts to build on and that there's an emerging consensus about what constitutes early childhood development. A draft plan of action that builds upon the finding of this asset review will be completed later this month. This is envisioned to be a strategic multi-year plan which lays out steps for action. Components of the plan are expected to include definition of an overarching goal, timeline for implementation, expected investments needed, action steps and outcomes, communications and advocacy plan, assignments of responsibility and accountability within the private, public, and nonprofit sectors. The draft plan will be discussed, vetted, and fine-tuned through a series of meetings and listening sessions with key stakeholders throughout the winter and early spring, with a final plan expected to be completed and adopted by stakeholders, including United Way, in mid-2009. In summary, Greater Twin Cities United Way is committed and focused to our early learning initiative as a key element of our agenda for lasting change. We look forward to working with this committee and all state and local policymakers towards ensuring that all Minnesota's children are prepared for school and for life. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think the business plan that you were talking about there at the end, members, is going to be really important. It's a strategic plan for early childhood. For us at the state and with our funding partners, it's sometimes hard to know where to go and what the best investments are, and we're hoping that that plan will spell out part of that or help us understand it. Are there any questions? You know, I just have one brief one, especially for the funders. You know, because we're really facing difficult times here with a $5 billion deficit, what is the best way, you know, besides money? I mean, we want to partner with you, but we need you too. I mean, that's just clear. And what do you think is the best way to have a partnership with you and to have productive outcomes here this session?
Well, I can speak, thank you, Madam Chair, I can speak to certainly the work that has been done with the caucus, and I think that the educator that's been acting as staff to the caucus has been effective in being able to bring in information to help inform you about other opportunities that might be working well in other states, about keeping you at the table looking at these different opportunities and working together. So that's one component. It's not an expensive component, but it's a key component. And secondly, I think the early childhood business plan that we've all been working on really has tremendous opportunity for you to be looking at where investments can be key and most effective. It's certainly something we as funders are looking at internally as a group, and we hope that the plan will be able to help inform you as well.
I would echo that on the business plan. We hope it's a tool and a resource for all of us figuring out how we best leverage the limited resources that we bring to the table. Maybe the other I would highlight, I'm delighted that there are folks here from kind of the K-12 part of the system, because that is one of the challenges I think we have. We really should be talking, you know, 0 to 21, kind of early childhood right up through post-secondary success. And so I think to the extent that committees talk and try and think how to align, again, the systems more seamlessly is going to serve us well in the future. So I would say in the time of limited resources, the more we can focus on some of these policy frameworks so that, like parents aware, so that as more resources are brought into the system, they really can be aligned across the many providers and different areas that we currently have. The more we can align those resources, I think the better leverage we get, and the more that we think about that transition and into the formal school system, that will be a service to the parents and the kids as well.
And that's a good point, Ms. Wolford. We have the chair of the K-12 finance division on this committee for that very reason, is that what we found, we would get the conference committee and we didn't know each other's committees very well. So I think it's very strategic. And also Carlos Mariani sits on this committee, who does K-12 policy, as well as many of the members cross over and are on both committees. Well, good. Well, if there's no other questions, thank you for being here, and appreciate you taking the time. Thank you. Next, we will call down, we're going to kind of have the child care groupings. We would do Jim Carlson, Carol Spector, and Ann McCulley, if they would like to come down together. And members, this isn't, it's helping you familiarize who the advocates are out there, but also, you know, what they have to bring. It's not just a cell job, it's more than that. Because sometimes I feel like we're just talking about the positive. You'll see, it's not, there's both sides to every issue, but I think it's really important that we see who's here. And then we need to approve the minutes. Representative Bly, do you have a chance to look at the minutes?
Yes, I have, and they are in order.
Okay. Is that a motion?
I would move that we approve the minutes.
Okay. Good. Representative Bly moves approval of the minutes for January 15th. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Representative Rosenthal, you were probably waiting for that, weren't you?
I was looking for a second chance to include my gas with it.
We do that on the first time. Well, welcome to the committee. We see you have an extra special guest. Maybe you should go first, Ms. Spector.
That's probably the safest. thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Carol Spector, and I'm the Legislative and Advocacy Affairs Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, and here is Jackson. Mm-hmm. So I come to the Early Childhood Committee with the full package. I have the baby, the book, and the formula on my shoulder.
How old is Jackson?
He's 9 months.
9 months.
Yes.
Great.
So just really briefly, quickly about Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. We're a statewide child advocacy organization, and our mission is to ensure that all children have a safe start, a healthy start, a moral start, a head start, and a fair start in life. We work to better the lives of Minnesota children through research, advocacy, and outreach. And I'm sitting here with the child care grouping and to show our support for early care and education along with the rest of the advocates in this room. I just want to echo what Madam Chair, Representative Fogg just said, we really hope that you view us as a resource. CDF does do a lot of research. We have a lot of available information on early education and other issues that impact families and children, which obviously will come into the discussion of this committee. And so access to quality and affordable early care and education for all Minnesota children is one of CDF's highest priorities. We are a multi-issue organization, but this is one of our highest priorities. And while we advocate on behalf of all children, we do place an emphasis on low-income children. Stealing the show. We place an emphasis on low-income children, and along with that, we have an emphasis on the child care assistance program. You will hear over and over, I think, from testifiers today that the child care assistance program has two very important roles, both helping parents to afford the high cost of child care and to stay in the workforce, as well as providing children with the opportunity to access early learning environments so that they can get the tools they need to thrive in school and in life. I think we're going to cover a lot about the child care assistance program and the child care infrastructure, so I thought I just would let you know that I'm here and focus on one of the most disturbing trends, I think, in Minnesota that will certainly come into play as this committee takes on its work, and that is the increasing child poverty rate. So just to let you all know that there are 143,000 children living in poverty in Minnesota. That's 12% of Minnesota's children. And the one of the more disturbing parts of that has been increasing. So between 2000 and 2007, that is a 35% increase. So for a state that really has a strong history of taking care of its children, I think this is one area where we can and should be doing better. Also, of particular relevance to this committee is 14.2% of children under the age of five, that's 50,000 children, are living in poverty. And the other somewhat disturbing piece of information about these numbers is that, is that they are 2007 numbers, and that's the most recent data available, but that does not capture the current economic downturn, and so unfortunately I think these numbers are probably only going to get worse. So I would just, you know, the ills of poverty really have adverse effects on children. I mean, it's been demonstrated they have adverse effects on children's brain and brain development. Children in poverty often start out behind and have a hard time catching up. And it just produces costly outcomes for our schools and our criminal justice system, our healthcare system, our future workforce. The list goes on. So I just tie it back to the work of this committee and going back to the two roles of CCAP. And that, again, is to provide economic security to families and to help parents work and to help and to give children access to early learning settings. Another statistic I would bring into this is to let you know that sometimes a little help with child care is all people need, that when the Department of Human Services has done its study in the past of why people apply for the Minnesota Family Investment Program or Welfare to Work Program after losing a job, so that's the number one reason, but consistently the number two reason for people applying for parents of young children is because they can't afford child care. So just that little bit of help sometimes allows people to stay in the workforce. And I think you have heard and will hear more about the high cost of child care. So, you know, I would just say in closing that while I wanted to share with you these poverty trends is something for fodder of discussion in this committee, I think it is incumbent upon us all to ensure all Minnesota children have access to quality early parent education. Investing in our children is going to bring returns to the broader community manyfold. So I just want to thank all of you for your commitment to early care and education, and I look forward to working with all of you on behalf of Minnesota children.
Well, thank you, and thank you for bringing Jackson in. He's very cute. Members for Children's Defense Fund, if you're not familiar with them, I think there's one in every state. Would that be right?
Madam Chair, we have a national office and then I believe seven state offices.
Seven state offices. So if you're looking for information, whatever information you might need, I found it to be a very helpful resource.
And a lot of our research is on our website, so, and you can always contact me as well.
Thank you. Good. Well, welcome to the committee. I think we'll take, who would like to go next?
Mr. Carlson? On the mic, I guess I'll go.
If you'd like to go ahead.
Thank you. I'm Chair and members of the committee. My name is James Carlson, and I'm the Director of Public Policy of Child Care Work. Thank you very much for having us. We're a statewide coalition of child care advocates and individuals, and we serve as a voice for child care in Minnesota in the larger discussion around early childhood. I'm here today because Susie Brown, our executive director, is out of town today, and she sends her regrets. A major function of Child Care Works is to bring together child care advocates, individuals, and organizations to collaboratively develop child care public policy initiatives that address three specific areas, which you already heard: affordability, accessibility, and quality of child care. Our primary stakeholders, if you will, are most certainly children, and at-risk children are the priority. To that end, we work closely with parents, child care providers, child care research and referral organizations, anti-poverty and school readiness organizations, the Minnesota Initiative Foundations, trade groups, and many others. You've heard, we set a goal to hire work participation of women in the nation. This is a major factor to the strong economy we have had in the state. But that also means that about 3/4 of the young children are in some kind of non-parental care for some portion of their time. We also know the research is exceedingly clear on the architecture of your young children's brains. We know that children are learning all the time in whatever setting they are, and we know that at-risk children are much more sensitive to the settings they're in, particularly during their early years. In Minnesota, most of our young children are in child care settings, whether it's a child care center, a licensed family child care home, or a family friend or neighbor. Given that this is the case, and given that the kind of information you will be hearing soon from Art Rolnick on the public return on investment for good quality of early education, I argue that it's not only the state's role, but it's in the state's best interest for balancing future budget deficits to ensure that Minnesota families can find and afford the best quality child care for their children, because those are, in fact, the early learning settings those children are in. We don't want to miss those early opportunities. Those children will never get the opportunity back again. We also know that in Minnesota, child care is extremely expensive. You heard the presentation from Sherry Kotelnik from the Department of Human Services last week about the cost of child care and how the state reimbursement rate is falling behind the market. For families with two young children, child care easily can cost over $20,000 a year, about double the cost of tuition at the U. For upper-income families, child care usually takes up about 7% of their income, while for low-income families, child care can cost up to 30% of their gross income. In our current economic crisis, it's very important that parents don't choose to leave their jobs because of child care costs. Employers will likely choose not to fill that vacancy anytime soon, continuing a decline in state revenue. In addition, families with young children are usually at low point of income earnings, given that they're likely in an early stage of their career. It's not hard to see, then, that the cost of child care is a huge concern for parents of all income levels, but especially for low-income families. One final but important point. There has been an artificial divide that's sometimes stated between what is child care or early learning or early education. In our field, we talked about it as early care and education, an acknowledgement that these terms are essentially one and the same. I hope to be helpful to you throughout the session as you learn about early care and education, and to be available to you as complex questions arise with important information about Minnesota child care. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Ms. McCauley, if you'd like to proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. There was a handout that gave you some statistics about child care resource and referral services, and also a map with our regions and our agencies, so you can see where your local agency is just as I speak. I am with an executive director of the Child Care Resource and Referral Network, and we are actually a separate 501c3 agency that was created in 1992 to provide technical assistance, training, and coordination to the Child Care Resource and Referral agencies around the state to collect data regarding the supply of and demand for child care, and to create and manage statewide projects. The core functions of the resource and referral system are in statute, and they were covered during the DHS presentation last Thursday, but our agency and some of our partner agencies also go beyond these duties with additional foundation funds to fulfill our mission, which is to build a diverse, high-quality child care system accessible to all Minnesota families. We work in collaborations with just about everybody in this room to inform public policy, particularly through bringing forward the data that we know and we hear from parents and providers, because we work with both audiences. And I'll touch briefly on some examples of how I hope we can be helpful to you as well. A key function of the resource and referral system is to support parental choice in child care. So we do that through information and education to parents about what is out there, how do they make choices. We have a database of all of the licensed programs in the state, and providers can access those through either, parents rather can access those either through the websites that we maintain or through individual calls to their local child care resource and referral. And we served over 33,000 families with that service last year. We know that choosing child care is one of the most important decisions that families make, but can be a daunting task. The child care market is complicated, the terminology is unclear sometimes. You've heard that quality care is important for the social, emotional, and cognitive development of children, but recognizing quality care is sometimes unclear. For families facing language, access, or income barriers, finding and choosing care is even more complex. So again, parent choice in early care and education has been long a hallmark of our child care system in Minnesota. As you consider the bills this year dealing with early learning opportunities, which do place parents at the center of that choice, it will be key to include a focus on giving parents access to information and support in that choice making. We also hope you'll consider some access issues, and others have touched on this, but I will reiterate, particularly for parents receiving child care assistance. Since 2003, our state has not only lost providers, we've made it harder for parents to afford care. As a result, the choices truly available to low-income parents have shrunk considerably. You will see some trend lines on statistics from our yearly follow-up survey on the back of the sheet that I provided, and it asks parents about barriers to their search for care. This last year, while we were seeing what looked like a promising decline in those statistics and some of those barriers, we started to see them go up again. In particular, a third of our surveyed families who used our services last year reported that cost of care was a barrier in their search, and nearly half of the families reported they had difficulty in finding the type, the schedule, or the location of the care they needed. And while the decline has stabilized somewhat on the question of quality, we still had 14% of families indicate that a lack of quality care was a barrier, which leads to another main function of the child care resource and referral system, building the supply and improving the quality of care. Our system provides infrastructure support for early care and education providers in several ways. Many of them are listed on your sheet. We run the Teach Early Childhood Scholarship Program and the Retain Wages Program. Those are both programs that help providers either go back to school and get their degree or reward those who have their degrees and keep them in the field. Service development grants, the resource and referral agencies provide these directly to providers. They're small, but they're necessary supports for some of the basic curriculum needs or bricks and mortar improvements. And ongoing professional development and training opportunities take place both at the community level and through the Eager to Learn online training program. And as many people have commented today, another important program that runs out of the network office right now is the Parent Aware Quality Rating System. Our office serves as the front door for child care providers who want to go through that program, as well as the information resource right now for parents as to who has been rated. What we have found is there really is a hunger and an interest in professional development, but many times what providers lack are sustainable resources to get to those opportunities and access in general. Those things get in the way. There is the interest, but not always the resource. Over 2,200 training or individual conference sessions were attended by 34,000 providers last year on topics including health and safety, child growth and development, learning environments and curriculum, and professional development and leadership. We need to continue to provide access to these infrastructure supports and take away any barriers to participation for providers, such as cost, language, or distance, by continuing to invest in the infrastructure. In recent years, our system has also included a growing focus on family, friend, and neighbor providers, those who may care for a grandchild one day a week for 6 months, or a neighbor caring for a child on an ongoing daily basis for several years. Wherever children are in care, we want those caregivers to have access to information and support. With over 46% of families using this type of care as their primary source, it's critical that we do so. Finally, child care resource and referral agencies work in collaboration at the community level all around your state. And again, I would direct your attention to the map and the list of agencies, taking what we learn from parents and providers into discussions about the local early childhood needs. I would urge you to continue to encourage collaboration between the early childhood programs at all levels. Parents and children who utilize early childhood programs do not experience them as distinctly different entities. They want access to quality experiences for their children that meet their needs, period. As Jim mentioned, we sometimes have struggled to make clear to decision makers that child care is early education. And whether a child is in a preschool room at a child care center or a school-based program, in a standalone preschool or Head Start program, or of preschool age and is spending their day with a family child care provider, quality learning can happen given proper supports and resources. You'll have the opportunity this session to provide these needed elements. On behalf of the child care resource and referral staff around the state and the 14,000 child care providers and programs, and most importantly, the estimated 367,000 children who spend some portion of their day in licensed child care and their parents, thank you for the opportunity to provide these comments.
Thank you. Members, are there any questions? Representative Greiling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. McCauley, how many states have these networks?
Ms. McCauley?
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, just about every state at least has some child care resource and referral system. I would say about 3/4 of the states have something akin to a network office. Some are larger than others, but the concept of resource and referral, however small it might be, is in just about every state.
Thank you. Thank you. And it is a very important concept. It's hard to, there's so many layers in all of this, but the statewide, this will touch all of you. It will have a child care resource and referral network somewhere where your district is. We're going to have the next group come up, but I just have to ask you one question. Aside from funding, what's one policy decision you hope we make this year in this committee? Ms. McCauley.
Madam Chair, you would call on me.
First.
I will say that I'm pleased, as many people have reflected on the framework that the Early Childhood Caucus has put forward, and building on the concept of a quality rating system, I think probably what I would bring to the table is just to make sure that in the course of whatever moves forward, we not forget those infrastructure and support pieces, either for parents or for providers.
Thank you.
Since money is not on the table, I will agree with that we're in full support of the quality rating system as it goes full to the statewide.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thanks for being here today. And we'll call our next group. We're going to have actually four come up. Deanne, Gina, Tisa, Lisa, and Gail Kelly. And thank you to Jackson, too, and Children's Defense Fund. I'm sure members, if I asked about funding, everybody might say the same thing, so that would be easier to ask about policy. Well, in the order of the agenda, if we started with Deanne, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I apologize, I have a bit of a cold, so hopefully we'll both get through this. But my name is Deanne Besh, and I'm the Vice President of Operations at Especially for Children Child Development Centers. And I'm here today representing the Minnesota Child Care Association as their Vice Chair of Government Relations. I sit on the board of MCCA as well. MCCA, or the Minnesota Child Care Association, represents over 200 child care centers throughout the state of Minnesota. And these centers employ over 4,000 teachers and staff members. Nearly 14,000 children attend our centers, and approximately 15 to 20% of their families utilize the child care assistance program. Excuse me. We believe that it's extremely important to our state's economy, as well as the most valuable resource, our children, to ensure that all children have access to quality early care and education. In order for children to have access, there must be a commitment to fair reimbursement rates for the care and education providers deliver. As you know, low-income families, even during strong economic times, are among the most vulnerable members of our society. This cannot be the time to limit their resources. It is the time to invest in these children and their families. When the economy is suffering, it is important that these families remain in the workforce or committed to their education in an effort to improve their lives and ultimately the state's economy. If families lose their funding and leave the workforce, they will become more costly to the state, requiring additional subsidies. In addition, their children will not have access to an environment which supports their early learning and preparing them for kindergarten. The current reimbursement rates have not been adjusted since 2005. Most providers are subsidizing these families beyond what the state provides by not charging the difference to the families of the cost of care provided and the rate covered by the state. For example, in Wright County, Especially for Children's weekly rate for preschool children is $212 a week. And the county reimbursement rate is $185 a week. Especially for Children does not charge the difference to the family, which they could, but they probably wouldn't have any subsidized children in their building. So nearly 25% of our rate is being subsidized by the center or by the company. During strong economic times was the time to invest in child care and rates. However, that didn't happen. If it had, I believe our message today might be different. We all need to do our fair share in order for the budget to be balanced. However, because child care has been underfunded, creating a fair rate concern, as well as waiting lists of thousands of qualified Minnesotans, we strongly believe that there's nothing left to cut without doing significant damage to these families and further damage to our state's economy. Research will tell you that providing access to high-quality early childhood experiences is the best state investment we can make. We need you to support these children, their families, and the many employees and child care centers throughout the state of Minnesota by, at a minimum, maintaining the current level of funding or following the lead of our federal government and making a tough decision to further invest in our most valuable resource. I'd also like to offer, as you begin your work as a committee, MCCA as a resource if there's ever an opportunity for us to provide information to you or access to families or our centers. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And testifiers, I have to remind you to try to keep it to 3 minutes. So we'll make sure we end on time and get everybody in. Next, CISA. Would you like to go ahead? CISA.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cisa Keller. I'm the Director of Advocacy and Government Relations for New Horizon Academy. New Horizon Academy represents almost 60 child care centers throughout the state of Minnesota, 52 of which are nationally accredited by the National Association for the Education of Young Children. These centers care for and provide early childhood experiences for over 6,000 children, 18% of whom utilize the Child Care Assistance Program. We employ over 1,600 Minnesotans in our centers. We're providing a service that allows thousands of Minnesota families to work or to continue looking for work. I want again, once again, thank you for taking the time to look at the issues facing low-income families trying to get access to child care help in Minnesota. When you make it tough to get child care in Minnesota, you make it tough for low-income families who have children to get and stay in the workforce. When the economy is suffering, we certainly don't want families leaving the workforce. In addition, we want to prepare the workforce of tomorrow, which is what quality child care does. Investing in child care is a smart move, even in tough economic times. Child care is about state investing in human capital, both today and tomorrow. As any parent knows, you can't succeed in the workforce when you have no peace of mind about where your children are and how they are doing. Any good parent puts their child first. If they don't feel their child is in a good, safe learning environment, they either find a way to leave the workforce or they're never able to concentrate enough to be successful while there. Child care can be seen as an economic stimulus package for today and, in addition, a workforce development for tomorrow. Child care is about economic development. Both current research and leading economists will tell you that providing access to high-quality early childhood experiences is the best state investment we could make. You can cite the current deficit as a reason for not funding child care properly, but even when we had a $1 billion surplus, we didn't fund it properly. This problem won't be fixed until we find true legislative champions who are determined to fix this problem and won't take no for an answer. We hope that will be some of you in this committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, did you write that or did Chad Dunkley write that?
I said that all by myself.
That part about true legislative champions was a little bit.
I did steal that phrase from
you. I think I've heard that before.
It was hard to break into this computer, though. So.
Members, for those of you who don't know, Chad Dunkley is the president.
He is the CEO of New Horizon Academy and the president of the Minnesota Child Care Association.
So, and he probably would be here, but he's been very sick.
Correct.
So, members, really keep him in your prayers.
Yeah,
I think he's home now.
He is home, and figured you would all appreciate a little bit of a break from him.
Oh, well, somehow I'd let him know he was here in conscience anyway.
Absolutely. But
thank you. Ms. Thompson, if you'd like to go next, welcome to the committee.
Hi, thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Excuse me. My name is Lisa Thompson, and I am really very grateful to have the opportunity today to come before you and tell you a little bit about a lesser-known but still very significant arm of the early learning system, and that's family child care. For those of you who are not familiar with family child care, we are licensed according to state law and regulated on the county level. We transform our homes to providing a stimulating, loving, and safe environment for a small, mixed-age group of children from birth through the early school years. I've been a licensed family child care provider here in Ramsey County for the past, over 15 years. And I come to this field with the educational background of a licensed elementary teacher. So I am attuned to the educational needs of children, and I am here to tell you today that children are learning in family child care. A day in family child care may look different than other learning care environments, early care environments, but the education children are receiving is meaningful and significant. In family child care, parents are being supported in their role as a child's first teacher by our special relationship with families and the expertise that we can provide them. In family child care, young children are being prepared for success in kindergarten. In addition to the some of the academic skills like letter sounds, literacy begins in infancy, and this is long before a child arrives in that four-year-old school-based program. Being ready for kindergarten also means developing those social skills that are required for school success and an excitement for learning. School readiness is happening in thousands of family child care homes all across our state. Having worked in the public school system, I also come to the family child care field with an understanding of the empowering nature of workers' unity through a union, and I'm presently serving as president of the union for my county for family child care providers called Child Care Providers Together, CCPT. Now, working with CCPT has provided me opportunity to speak out as an advocate for the education of young children in this unique environment. This has been especially important for family child care, where working alone with children for 60-plus hours a week is the norm, and that leaves little opportunity to be heard at this level. In partnership with Ramsey County Human Service Department, the County Public Health Department, and the St. Paul Public Schools, CCPT has worked to develop a peer mentoring project to support the highest quality of care and education to families using family child care. A solid start in these early formative years is really the best investment that society can make. And early education does not take the place of good parenting. And family child care is not seeking to take the place of good parenting. Family child care, we are another part of creating a solid foundation for our next generation. And I ask you to please allow me to be a resource to this committee as someone who works on the front line every day with young children. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Thomas, could you tell us a little bit about the kids in your child care and how many hours you work and some things like that?
Yes, Madam Chair. I work average of 60 hours a week, just including a direct child one-on-one time. I serve 10 children under school age and 14 total. They come from, most of them, my neighborhood, which is very east side, very inner city. I have children from every walk of life, some that are needing assistance through the county program, and some that could choose a much higher price, but certainly unbiased, but not as high quality as my home. I serve the full range.
And to get here today, I mean, what we often hear is you've got kids probably being picked up right now, right around this time. So you have a substitute, or how did you handle being at this hearing here today?
Absolutely. The first 13 years that I did this, I worked alone and rarely was able to get away from my home during those daytime hours. Within the last 2 years, I have hired an assistant to work side by side, so his children are very used to them, and allows me the opportunity to get away with this, coming away from, getting away from the house and coming to a place like this.
Did you say get away with it?
I didn't do that.
Wow, I think that's the first time we heard that. Because we are thrilled to see you and happy. I know that, members, we do not often see the home child care providers, but has, especially the timing of this committee, being at the end of the day, and it's pick up time for parents and so forth. So we appreciate you being here.
Thank
okay,
you.
Good. Ms. Kelly, would you like to go next?
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gail Kelly. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Head Start Association. Thank you very much for this opportunity to share a little bit about Head Start. The Minnesota Head Start, oh gosh, and I'm just learning how to use these, so maybe I'll hold it over here. Wow. Okay.
We can
I just had a thing. No one understands that, right?
Being middle-aged, we do understand. I understand that very well.
The Minnesota Head Start Association represents Head Start and Early Head Start programs across Minnesota's 87 counties, 7 tribal nations, and also serves migrant camps across Minnesota. Minnesota Head Start uniquely combines state-of-the-art early childhood learning experiences with decades of experience in childhood poverty to serve school readiness one family at a time. And we really emphasize family services. This is a family and child development program. Head Start welcomes you to come visit. All of you have Head Start programs in your districts, and the best way to understand this program is to visit. And we have nonprofit agencies, community action agencies, tribal governments, and one school district, all providing services in your community. So please, just let me know. We'd be happy to set up a visit for you. They write grants. They bring money into your communities. They are an economic engine in your communities. A total of $84 million comes directly into your local community thanks to the efforts of those programs operating Head Start programs. They hire staff, around 32,000 staff. About 1,000 of those are teachers, and right now about 80% of those are degreed teachers. They purchase services, they purchase food, fuel, education materials, and they invest in infrastructure and programming across your communities. So please get to know the infrastructure that's Head Start in your local communities. Last year, Head Start's Family and Child Development Services reached 14,424 children under the age of 5. This represents about 32% of those children with families living at or below the poverty level in Minnesota. This isn't an entitlement program. You can only serve as many children as we're funded to serve. From 05 to 08, that coverage dropped 10%. We were up in 2005, we were up around 42%. And that was primarily because of flat funding and the fact that our poverty rate, as Carol mentioned, is increasing dramatically for children, particularly children in very deep poverty. So right now we're not able to keep up with where we've been before in terms of coverage. And we don't have data from this year, but let me tell you, our waiting lists are a testament of what's happening to our families. In Roseau, they cut 2 shifts at the Polaris factory. That means 2 incomes for many of the families that we serve. We're seeing those families coming to Head Start who before weren't income eligible. Here in Minneapolis, when the foreclosure hit, many landlords got foreclosed on, which left more and more families in homeless shelters. We're serving more homeless families than ever before. So our waiting lists reflect the economic times. We provided you a fact sheet, and I hope you'll take a look at that. It should be in your packets. If not, we'll make sure to pass it around. And it really details more about what Head Start is. It talks about the research that shows that Head Start is a quality, has high outcomes for children. It even has some Minnesota child outcome data. I really want to emphasize that Head Start, over 40 years, has been guided in the most critical research around early childhood development. We, before anyone else, were using research-based curricula and using instructional assessment in our classrooms. We have been committed to learning the state-of-the-art in terms of children's mental health and social-emotional development. And we are always changing in terms of implementing state-of-the-art research on early child care and education. So please, again, I encourage you to visit. And let me just say we'll have 3 primary legislative objectives this session. One, in these economic times, we will work with you to protect Minnesota's investments in early care and education. We do not want to see Minnesota falter and leave more at-risk children behind. It is imperative that we invest now so our population is ready for tomorrow's opportunities and challenges. We will advocate that you consider serving more at-risk children this year. Because again, we need a down payment on economic stability in the future. And we know these children are only under 5 for 5 years. Finally, we will help you to figure out how we can expand our early Head Start, because we know many of the children in our state need to start early. And there are ways without any increased cost that we can allow more programs to reach out to those infants and toddlers that are living in poverty here in Minnesota. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I just have a quick question for you and then members if there's any questions. We know we've been hearing a lot about the federal stimulus package, and in particular Head Start has been mentioned a lot. Can you tell us what you've heard that might come to Minnesota and
sure.
How that is going?
I'm lucky I'll be going to Washington next week and after the crowds have left, hopefully. But yes, the U.S. House has put Head Start and child care into the economic stimulus package. $2.1 billion for Head Start and $2.0 billion for child care. We are seen as an economic engine. We have an opportunity to hire women and get people employed immediately. We have waiting lists that are ready for expansion. And our new president is committed to quadrupling early Head Start. And so about a billion of that is for Head Start and about 1.1 is for early Head Start expansion. Now that's in the House bill. We haven't seen the Senate bill and there's many discussions about trimming that back. So again, it's always uncertain what's going to happen on the federal level.
Representative Greiland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kelly, will there be any maintenance of effort requirements from the federal government, knowing that in 2003 Head Start was cut?
Ms. Kelly.
Yes, sir. It's absolutely right. We are so, the infrastructure is so fragile right now that if that money doesn't go through the formula, it'll be difficult for us to expand. But if it goes through the existing formula, it will allow for cost of living increases, and our teachers have not seen that for 2 years. It will also allow for quality improvement dollars so that we can hopefully rehire the staff that we've had to cut back on to keep going.
Representative Greiland?
I'm not sure. I was talking about maintenance of effort, like for special education funding and the K-12 budget. If we get money from the federal government, we cannot cut, I cannot supplant what we are doing in the state. You have to maintain your state effort, and then the federal money has to be new money on top of that. And I'm wondering with Head Start, if the federal stimulus package comes through, as it hopefully it sounds like it will, if there will be any restrictions so that in the state of Minnesota we cannot cut Head Start as was done in 2003.
Ms. Kelly?
I have no way of answering that. We haven't seen the details, although there has been discussion that to take money on the state level. See, this would go directly to local communities, but it has been discussed. I think even our governor said that if it comes through the state, there may be strings attached to that money to ensure that states couldn't cut. And I haven't heard if that provision is attached. I certainly will be asking next week. Thank you very much.
Good questions. Well, thank you. We appreciate you being here. We're going to move on to the next group. Any other questions? Okay, well, it's Steve Kerr, Sharon Henry Blythe, Jill Briggs. And we're all kind of wondering what's going to happen to federal stimulus money. I mean, if it's Head Start, it could be a lot of money, but you're right, if it supplants state money, it makes you wonder if it's going to be mixing pots of money, moving them around, mm-hmm. And that's not going to be very good. Good. I think we'll start in the order of steps on the agenda. Welcome to the committee. We'll start with Mr. Kerr.
My name is Steve Kerr. I'm the Community Education Director in the Hennepin School District. I've served as a representative of MCA and have been in a leadership role with MCA as president and past president most recently. This committee deals with a lot of things, and I'll talk about some broader scopes of those things. Community education is a public education system. It's housed in all of your school districts. It provides a range of services in lots of variety and lots of flavors in the local school district. And I'll probably start on one end, which would be the early education end. And we provide services with early childhood family education, which is intended as a parent education program, school readiness as a program for preparing children for kindergarten. We then move into some of our other programs, school age care program. We have a school age care program example in Okehennepin. We serve about 3,000 kids in after school child care programs. We have thousands and thousands of kids in Okehennepin who participate in after school programs from arts, crafts, and enrichment, athletics, you name it, a variety of those things. Primarily because our families are two major earner families, most of them out of the community from 3 to 6 p.m. with at least a half-hour commute. It's important for us to provide some safe alternatives for our families, for their children when they're out of the community. So that's why we get so heavily involved with youth programs in our community. We also then moving into the adult, and I should say the other programs in there that I forgot, youth service is another large one we do, which we work with providing service opportunities in our communities for our children to participate in. And in Okehennepin, that looks like we provide service opportunities at our high schools, and those high school students participate in those and gain credit for those in their social studies classes as a result of that. In our adult programs, we provide adult learning opportunities for our adults, adult basic education, and adults with disabilities is another program that we offer in community education. Our role in all of these programs is varied as you look at our various school districts across the state. The purpose of the legislation is to provide flexibility in that, allows the dollars that we receive from state sources to be leveraged with local partnerships and agencies to extend those dollars. In many cases, those dollars are leveraged on a 7-to-1 ratio as you look at our total funding. An area that's become extremely important for us of late is the transition for our high school students to post-secondary or our laid-off workers into post-secondary sorts of situations. And in Okehennepin, we're working directly with our community college, technical college providers so that we can provide a place where students who are not quite up to speed on their skills for those settings, and their skills can be brought up to a level where they can be successful in those settings. Those are some of the kinds of things that we get involved with. We certainly have concerns. Madam Chair, I've given this speech, I think, 3 years in a row in front of your committee, and I was trying to think that I do something entertaining or something today to make this different, but clearly I have some concerns. We have some concerns around the early education arena. I remind this committee that in school readiness, the program that we have in the public education sector, the state started that program in 1991, I believe, was the legislation. First year of funding was 92. The state allocated $10 million to that program in 92 to serve about two-thirds of the school districts in the state. Currently, I believe our current investment is somewhere in the neighborhood of $10.5-$11 million statewide. It is now going to all of the school districts, and I remind you, both inflation and population growth have occurred since 1991. So I think what we would see in our community is, and I'll speak for my staff, I feel I have staff who know what these children need. We've had record of success in making a dent in the academic achievement of those children. We've got good staff development. We've got good assessments. We've got some really nice curriculum. We're just a little short on money, a lot short on money, and so that's an issue for us. And we see, as many of the testifiers have, that our communities are experiencing greater stress, and that stress is transferring into some of our families and the family structures and all the issues that go with that. At the same time, counties have cutting back on services and those kinds of issues. So those are some of the things we're seeing in our communities as we try to move forward and work with that from a public education standpoint. We, at this time, don't have the resources to help with those families the way that we feel we could. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll cease.
Thank you. Well, we appreciate you being here. Very brief question. If you are helping a child after school or someone's taking a pottery class, there's different fee structures, right?
That'd be correct.
Could you explain that a little bit?
It varies so widely. In the school readiness program, if you're going into that end, the school readiness end, the statute would require us to have a sliding fee scale and waive the fees for those families who can't afford it. So it depends on the program and the legislative language of the statute. In a after-school program, it depends. We work with many of our local, in other words, our municipalities provide some funding for those things. So So what we do, generally speaking, in terms of the direction we give to our staff, Madam Chair, is that we try to recover the cost of the instructor and the supplies and the materials, and that the combination of funding we have for some of our after-school youth programs, that we use funding from our local funding partners as well as the general community education levy, which is a funding stream in community ed, to help pay for some of those after-school programs for kids. Adult programs, we ask the adult programs, by statute, they need to pay all of those direct expenses for the program, so that's what happens. Adult basic education, you are not allowed to charge fees for. So it depends on the program and the service area, but it does vary widely, but those are the general categories.
Thank you. And members, I just hope we understand when we're going to be a lot of pressure this year, and I think that community ed is going to come under the microscope like everything else, is that this is all laid out in statute and the different fees and why things happen. So I think, Mr. Curry, you just need to help us continue to understand that, because it is complex like the other areas.
Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. And next we have Sharon Henry Blythe. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good evening, Madam Chair and committee members. Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you this evening. I am Sharon Henry Blythe. I'm the Director of Children and Family Policy and Research for the Family Supportive Housing Center. I have come to speak to the committee on behalf of the center and the roughly 3,000 homeless children and formerly homeless children in the state of Minnesota. The Family Supportive Housing Center serves 17 supportive housing organizations serving homeless and formerly homeless families. I've recently completed the Infant Toddler Discovery Project, which you are receiving a copy of the executive summary, which is a community-driven research project designed to help us better understand the needs of families with very young children who've experienced homelessness. Young children who've been homeless face dramatically reduced opportunities for healthy development. Toddlers living in homeless families begin to demonstrate significant developmental delays after 18 months of age, at the risk for poor social, emotional, and cognitive developmental outcomes increase as children progress from early childhood to school age. Through our research, we gain knowledge about the realities of homeless families with very young children and the staff that support them. One thing that we learned is risk escalates with age. Using the home inventory, we were able to assess the homes of 185 families living in supportive housing. A big, big learning from that, a big finding from that, is that at the infant toddler age of 0 to 2, one-third of the children are at what we consider risk for developmental difficulties. So infants and toddlers are doing fairly well in their homes with their parents. By the time children get to 3 years old, about two-thirds of the children are now experiencing difficulties. So we're seeing risk escalates with age. We also learned that access to early childhood opportunities seems to be very limited for these families. About half of the families are using a child care program, a child care center, or many fewer using family child care. About half out of 185 families. So why are these families are primarily infant eligible, yet we have about half of the children that aren't receiving any type of early childhood enrichment opportunity. Parenting support services are very limited. While many programs offer parenting classes, only two of the parenting education curricula were identified by staff as research-based. None of the curriculum I found was evidence-based, would be considered evidence-based. And the two research curriculum that were being used started at 3 years old. So there was nothing that the staff were using that I could identify that targeted the developmental needs of children below three, and the curriculum was primarily violence prevention. It was not focused on the developmental needs of the children and supporting the families and supporting their children's developmental needs. Out of the 17 programs I looked at, four of them had on-site child care. There were 17 programs, but 23 sites. Some of them had dual sites. Four of the sites had on-site child care. With the exception of two of those sites, the families in the supportive housing were not accessing the child care programs on site. When we tried to understand why is this, considering most of these families, keep in mind, are infant eligible, we believe that it's because of the infant status of the parent. If the parent is not meeting their requirements for eligibility, the children are not receiving the benefit of access to child care. And if the parent is receiving, is participating, and for some reason drops off, the child is removed from the child care program. And child care is not an easy business to run. And it's very rare that a program can afford to keep the child if there is not any funding available to care for that child. So we have what we call the Visible Child Legislative Initiative, which is an initiative of the Supportive Housing Provider Group and the Family Supportive Housing Center. We recommend three very important things. One, children that have experienced homelessness, have immediate access to a quality early childhood experience and a guaranteed access to a quality early childhood experience. We recommend delinking the parent's infant status from the child's ability to access the early childhood experience. We think it's very important. This would allow children to have experienced homelessness ongoing and uninterrupted access to an early childhood opportunity. We also highly recommend building capacity of staff within shelters and supportive housing to support families with very young children through evidence-based parent education and support designed for families with children 4 and younger, training and professional consultation to help staff work with children who've experienced the trauma of homelessness, and grants to ensure developmentally appropriate space is available for very young children. Last, I want to say to you, it is not our intent to create a new program or a new infrastructure. We simply want to make sure that these children who could be considered high risk of high risk have access to the support and the families have access to the supports and services they need to promote the health and well-being of the children. And with that, I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you. Members, just so you know, and for folks in the audience, we have just one more group to come up, and that'll be Laura LaCroix-DeLune and Tom Citrin-Heisen. So we'll go with Ms. Briggs and then move from there. Ms. Henry Blythe, I just have a question for you. I mean, when we went on a Poverty Commission tour, homeless kids were eligible for Head Start, and they got the first slots in Head Start. Is that not work that way everywhere?
Well, I think because there is a waiting list in Head Start, and there's just not enough funding available to allow these children to immediately access Head Start. We have been having conversations with Head Start in the hope that we can figure out how we can address this issue. But I think that the lack of funding and the lack of slots available are preventing children from accessing.
Okay, I hope we can work on that, and members also with making childcare child-centered instead of the dropping out and dropping off is a big issue,
mm-hmm.
and is hurting a lot of families.
It is, yes.
Thank you. Ms. Briggs?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jill Briggs. I'm the Community Health Services Administrator and the Public Health Director for the Great County of Chicago. I'm also the co-chair of the Minnesota Coalition for Targeted Home Visiting, and I chair that committee with Jane Kretzman from the Minnesota Community Foundation. As you know, home visiting is not funded in this committee. However, Minnesota communities require a robust continuum of effective programs for children and families in need of early childhood services. We certainly heard a collection today, so that's great fun. And we work together. In home visiting, we work together with our community partners to really look at the continuum of services. Although I'm now an administrator and a director, the roots of my career were in home visiting. For 10 years, I saw these families and the communities they lived and learned a great many things from them. One thing I might suggest that you and home visitors have in common is that we have to somehow figure out how to meet someone we don't know and get their support and help them learn. So not only do you have to influence, but we have to gain their trust. If I called you up and said, gee, I'd like to come do a home visit with you, you'd all be looking at me like, okay, lady, why should I let you in my door? So it takes some skill and some continuing support and standing in there with families. What I learned as a public health nurse is that from the parents I served, is that helping parents achieve relationships with their children in their own home environment is uniquely valuable. It's a valuable approach to nurturing parental competence and supporting early successful early childhood development. Here's an example. Went out on a home visit with some of our partners in the school system, see a young family, they had a 2-year-old child, and the therapist had come out, because this little person wasn't talking yet. And I was a public health nurse, I'd seen that family for years, and couldn't figure out what was going on, so the school folks said, hey, just to get a cereal and put it on his tongue. And I'm a nurse, I've been doing this for a while, I said, well, why would I do that? Well, if you know, pronunciation involves moving your tongue a lot, and this little guy didn't know how to move his tongue, and that's how he learned it. My point is that home visiting is a collection and a working together of many different partners. In addition to supporting those parent-child relationships, home visits also result in lower public expenditures for services. This is not just talk. We have outcome data and research evidence to support the role home visiting plays in the mosaic of early childhood services. The RAND Corporation has suggested that the return on investment for one home visiting model is $5.78 for every dollar of expenditure. Our own Minneapolis Federal Reserve has an estimate of 5-to-1 return on investment. We have evidence that supports improved health outcomes, increased family financial stability. We work in child maltreatment prevention and improved school success. We start early. We see these folks when they're prenatally, and we keep seeing them till they're 2 and 3 and 4. Our state has a long history of supporting home visiting. In 1999, the Minnesota legislature recognized the importance of home visiting and supported funding for targeted home visiting. Although cuts were made in 2003, we are fortunate. We continue to have funding today for targeted home visits, and we are grateful. The Minnesota Coalition for Targeted Home Visiting plans to support the work you are doing and has as our purpose to secure stable sources for public funding and for private funding, so that voluntary, targeted home visiting is available statewide for high-risk parents and children prenatally to age 3. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. I know we're going to be hearing more from your coalition, so you're going to have plenty more opportunity to talk to more legislators, I think.
Okay.
I'm going to move to the next group. Thank you. Last, we have Tom Sitchin-Heisen and Laura LaCroix-DeLune. Members, our meeting on Thursday is the allowances and scholarships. So all of you that have a keen interest in allowances and scholarships need to be here with lots of questions. Representative Eileen, that would be you, maybe? Yeah. It'll be interesting because it's a great experiment, and so we'll be able to talk about that further. Good. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Tom Sitchin-Heisen, and I represent Literacy Minnesota, which is a statewide advocacy group for adult basic education. And it's always a challenge, a pleasure and a challenge, to testify before this committee, because we hear all of the very moving stories of young children and the services which they deeply need, and we know that very strongly. We also believe that it's important to see young children in the context of their families, and we know that the greatest indicator of children's academic achievements in K-12 is the academic achievements of their parents. And through adult basic education, we help parents learn a variety of critical literacy and academic skills that then allow them to help supplement their children's learning, help them prepare them for kindergarten, help them communicate with their children's teachers, and help them through the school process. So we don't want to lose sight of seeing children in the context not only of their community, the child care providers, and all the other really important services, but also in the context of their immediate families and what their families are able to offer them. We really want to also mention that we very much appreciate the past support you've gotten from this committee. You've always been very aware of the work that we do in adult basic education, why what we do we believe is very valuable, and really appreciate your support. At the same time, we know that there are, as you know, incredible fiscal pressures in Minnesota, and that there are lots and lots of causes vying for attention and support, and believe it's very important to try to identify those causes which are most able to help address some of those economic needs. We believe that what we do is very crucial in that effort. Our experience over the last several decades has been that when economic times are difficult, we see an increase in people coming into our learning centers around the state. During the 2002-2004 period, as we were in the last major recession, we saw a 60% increase in adults coming to our centers over the same period 4 years previously. And we're already, again, starting to see around the state here reports of vast increased numbers of adults coming to try to improve their skills. When people have been laid off, the deficits they may have in different academic areas, math, reading, other sorts of things, become even more important to be addressed so that they can hopefully achieve economic self-sufficiency again. We have, NAB for the last several years, have placed growing emphasis on helping adults to master the communication skills, the academic knowledge, and the study habits needed for post-secondary success. Because we realize that ABE by itself does not get people to good jobs, but we can help people get the skills that can help them succeed in both short and long-term higher education, maybe certified nursing assistant training, maybe training as child care providers, a wide variety of fairly short-term training programs that can help get people to living wages. But if they aren't able to master the communication skills and the academic study skills to get through those courses, they won't do very well.
We're gonna have to try to get the committee out on time. So are you almost done?
Yep, I am.
Good wrap up.
Just want to mention in passing that other aspects of ABE is the primary way in which immigrants and refugees learn English, that we are very lean and outcome-focused. Over 85% of all funding supports direct instruction. I'd like to quote just very briefly Hilda Solis, who's the nominee for Secretary of Labor, who recently said at her Senate hearing, "We must expand the skills development and job search assistance it provides to all workers so their employment opportunities will expand and their earnings will grow and employers will have the skilled workforces they need to succeed." So, as I close, some of you may remember a number of years ago, the last budget crisis, ABE was unallotted as more many programs. Through the support of your committee, we've just this last year got to the point where we're able to support what we do in a good way. So we hope that we'll be able to continue working with the committee to make sure that the adults that need basic skills training are able to access it. If any of you, if you have the time and are interested in scheduling a visit at the Hub Center right down University to see firsthand some of what we do, we'd be more than happy to host you. So thank you very much.
We may try to do that. Okay, you have 20 seconds. So fast. No, I'm just kidding. We'll give you your 3 minutes, members, if you can be courteous. Just look right, Luther Loon. We'd appreciate it. She works very hard, and sorry, Ian, somebody had to go last.
I know. That's all right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Laura LaCroix DeLune, and I'm the Executive Director at Youth Community Connections, and I gave you a very large packet of materials to read. If I can just highlight a couple of the important things, a little bit about who we are. We're a statewide alliance of both public and private stakeholders, so that's direct service providers, state agencies, cities, counties, private foundations, and training organizations. We're also part of a national network of 38 states across the country. So we are really devoting our attention and time to the non-formal learning that happens in the non-school hours. So that's before school, after school, summers, and weekends. We talk about it as after school, out of school time, and summer learning opportunities. For many, many years, we used to think this was just nice, that we would give our kids things to do so they'd be safe, so they wouldn't get into trouble. But research has been clear that when kids engage in quality after school and summer learning programs, that we actually make real gains academically. We're not just talking grades, we're talking test scores, and there's a lot of research out there that shows when kids engage in summer learning opportunities that we can actually reduce the achievement gap, and this is something that we've been grappling with for a long, long time. Not surprising here, what this comes down to is that it's about an opportunity gap. Middle-income families, upper-income families have been purchasing these opportunities for their kids for a long time. They've seen their kids soar. They've seen their kids grow. It's our kids in our low-income families that don't have these same opportunities. And so our low-income kids, not only do they start behind their peers as they enter kindergarten, they can learn at the same rate as their peers, but they fall further and further behind every summer that they don't have the same opportunities as my children have. So it's really important that we begin to address this. We know we can make academic gains. We know we can reduce the achievement gap, and that's some real cost savings to remedial education through the K-12 system. After school and summer programs have also been an essential way of helping kids enter the workforce. This is especially important for our middle school and high school students. In this country, since 2002, we've seen the teen job rate decline, and then across the country, it's been declining since 2000. With this recession, kids are going to be competing with adults for entry-level jobs. That means it's harder and harder and harder for kids to enter the job force, And so we're relying more and more on these kinds of non-school opportunities through service learning projects, summer programs, to get that job experience. It's critical to have positive experiences as we first enter the workforce or as we first enter the work system, because that really helps project how we move forward in life. That first job experience is very critical. The other thing that these opportunities provide communities is a way to reduce some of the community ills. We know that when kids, on average, have about 2,000 hours of non-structured time, that means that when they're not in school, when they're not sleeping, when they're not eating, that's about the equivalent of a full-time job. When kids are engaged in meaningful opportunities that help them learn and grow and develop, they do great things. When kids don't have access to these opportunities, we see crime rates increasing in communities across the state. We see increase of use of alcohol, drugs, and tobacco. We see increases in violence and crime.
Now you really do have 20 seconds. So,
consider various legislative proposals this session, and you will see many, we want you to think about how these types of opportunities really can help save resources for communities. We've been working with the mayors, we've been working with the schools, we've been working with the governor's office by hosting this summit here in this past May, and we are now here to work with you. I know your time, my time is up, so you have my card and our resources, and please feel free to give us a call if we can answer any questions.
Good. Thank you. With that, this meeting is adjourned.